Welcome to the show that explores the delectable world of fine wine and food throughout Santa Barbara. What to order, where to go, when to buy. From Stearns Wharf to Solvang and beyond. Hop on for a hayride through the grapevines and along the restaurant trails. This is Cork and Fork SB with your host, John Hennigan.
Welcome to Cork and Fork Radio. This is John Hennigan in studio with a very, very unusual, I guess, certainly an elite wine broker, and his name is Richard Torin. And Richard is, he deals in wine that most of us would never see or certainly get a chance to taste. But Richard, why don't I go ahead and let you introduce yourself and give us an idea what it is that you do with wine.
I'm what's known in the trade as a fine wine dealer. I deal in the the most expensive and the rarest wines from around the world, therefore principally from France, and have been doing so for the last 20 years.
And give us a range of what a very fine wine would cost.
Well, quite a spread, starting from $100. And the most expensive wine on our list is $20,000 a bottle.
Okay. How many of those bottles do you have?
At the moment, 3.
Wow. that certainly is fascinating. Now, let's kind of get an idea. First of all, there can't be too many wine brokers that do what you do.
There are, compared with the amount of total wine dealers or wine merchants or whatever, absolutely. We're very small. We represent our clientele, so you know, maybe 1% of the total, but not that many.
Right.
In America, maybe 12, 10, 15.
Total. And obviously, you must have been doing this for a long time, because I don't think you'd start out doing something like that.
The end of the Civil War.
Okay. Well, do you have wines from the Civil War?
No, I don't have no wines from the Civil War.
Okay.
We have dealt in wines going back to, well, now, of course, it would be the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
But principally now in more recent wines from the last 50 years.
Okay. And obviously, we're anxious to find out what makes a wine worth that kind of money. So why don't you give us an idea? We're going to be talking throughout the hour with you, so we'll have plenty of opportunity to get an idea about what goes into wine. And we're going to bring some other people on that probably know a lot more about wine than I do, and we'll kind of get an idea about, you know, what the difference is. Well, let's start with the easy stuff. I can see a $100 bottle of wine that might be really good, but what's the difference between a $30, $40 and a $100 bottle of wine?
Complexity. I was in Argentina 2 weeks ago, and you can have a bottle of Malbec with lunch for $15 in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. Tastes absolutely delicious. And it tastes delicious until you open the one for 30, which has got a bit more complexity, and 60 and 100, and so on and so forth. And at a certain level over that, the rarity, the laws of supply and demand, and the reputation of the vineyard all come into greater effect, and the vintage, of course.
Now, people that buy wines for, you know, let's say over $500.
Yes.
Do they drink those, or do they just store them, or is it, I guess it depends on what you can afford?
It's a panoply of reasons. Some people buy them for investment. Some people buy them for a rainy day. Mm-hmm. And there are others which do what they were made for, which is open the damn things and drink them.
Well, you know, some people can do that.
Yes.
Now, the age of wine, give us an idea. I know from my personal experience, a lot of people think that the older the wine gets, the better it gets, but we know that's not true.
No, wine, like everything else, has a sell-by date.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the chateaus with older vines make longer-lasting wines.
Mm-hmm.
Chateau Latour, for example, which is a first growth from Bordeaux, is particularly well-known for the longevity of its product. But what's happened in recent years is, like everything else, people are making, winemakers are making wine for more immediate consumption. The potential to age is there, but the potential for long aging is less, because they want to bring them to a consumer's, they want to make them mature enough to drink much faster.
Well, when you talk about age maturing, there's, I guess, the age before it goes in the bottle and the age after.
Yes.
Okay. And so, and I apparently, in a barrel, sometimes they'll leave it for maybe 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 years tops.
I think you're actually talking more about fortified wine. I don't think it's ever left in a barrel for more than 2 years. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong, but generally not.
Mm-hmm.
No, the grapes that are picked in 2009, for example, there's an 18-month hiatus before they're released, and then there's a period, and then they're delivered. It's 12 to 15 months, something like that, not that long.
And once the wine goes into the bottle, we understand that it should be in there for at least a short period of time before you open it.
Yes.
But how long, and what happens to it in the bottle?
Well, I mean, it matures. What does a cork in a bottle do? A cork prevents air getting into the wine, therefore it slows the maturing process. And one of the big things in recent years has been the rise of screw caps. Screw caps don't look as good as corks, but actually they're more effective. But they're never going to be put into more expensive Bordeaux because they're not cosmetically acceptable to your client.
Well, I can imagine that if someone's paying $100 for a bottle of wine, they probably want to have a little bit of a...
It's part of the routine. Right. You shove your corkscrew in, there's that satisfying, you know, where it comes out. Mm-hmm. And one of the beauties of older wines particularly is if you drink the wine over a 2 or 3 hour period, how the wine evolves and evolves. Something that can be quite undrinkable when you open it will be absolutely sublime 2 hours later.
Well, I'm certainly not an expert, but I've noticed when you have some of the cheaper wines, I won't name any names, but when you cork it and taste it, you go, oh, this is pretty good. But as you get towards the bottom of the bottle, you know, it becomes undrinkable.
Yes.
And whether the more expensive wines, you open it up and say, well, that's pretty good. But as you get down to the bottom, you go, wow, this is really good.
The terroir, the soil.
Oh, okay.
And the skill of the winemaker and the quality of the grapes. Mm-hmm. At a certain level, you're talking about mass blended wines against wines that come from one vineyard with old vines and are blended by an expert winemaker. Big difference.
Okay. Now, I think that we're going to go to a break, but what I'd like to find out is maybe talk a little bit about sparkling wines, but we're going to come back with somebody that I certainly know as one of the top winemakers in the Valley, John Falcone. So we're just going to take a 30-second or 1-minute break, and we'll be right back with you. You're listening to Cork and Fork Radio.
Stay tuned for more Cork and Fork SB coming up. Il Bustino greets you with a vista of gleaming tanks crafted in Italy, filled with fresh California oils and exotic vinegars. Selecting the right oil or vinegar is a personal sensory experience. Come in and taste from tanks to find what fresh, quality local ingredients can produce. Your taste buds will excite with flavors you've never experienced. Flavored vinegars, diverse and delicious. Award-winning flavored olive oil is made by crushing the fruit and herbs along with the olives, producing natural and intense flavor. Il Bustino is a local family-owned business on Upper State, west of the San Roque Post Office at 3401 State Street. Santa Barbara has a history with olives. Stop in and taste the distinctive results of olives milled just hours after a hand-picked harvest. From mild buttery to more robust blends made in the Italian tradition. Tapenades, dips, flatbreads, and spices. The best in unique specialty food products. You'll find it at Il Bustino, the truly tasteful experience. Now, back to the spicy trail with Cork and Fork SB.
This is Cork and Fork Radio with John Hannigan in studio with Richard Torin of Clarets, a very, very fine wine broker.
Distinguished. Let's use the word distinguished.
Okay. Well, speaking of distinguished, we also have the pleasure of John Falcone, who is one of the top winemakers in the Valley, and he's going to come in and join the party with us. And I'll let John, I'm sure he's got some questions for Richard, but John, thank you for coming in.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Okay. Now, before we went to the break, we were just talking a little bit about the maturization process. Is that the correct word?
Well,
is there such a word?
But you've got to be careful you don't confuse that with madarization, which you know, when a wine gets old, it loses its fruit, and that's called madarization.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, why don't we talk a little bit about, before we get into the real high-end stuff, about the difference that it takes to make a wine that's, say, $30 or $40 and wine that has a value of over $100?
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting question because I think if you are a new winery, you know, so much of this, I think, has to do with your property location. And so typically, higher priced wines, you know, come from areas that have a proven track record or appellation, such as Burgundy or Napa Valley, et cetera. So that would be the first step. Yet, there's so much else that goes into that, that the owner, you know, decides he's going to, let's say it's Napa Valley and he's making a Cabernet. Well, he's made this wine and he's hired some named winemaker to help him. You know, suddenly what price do they put on the bottle? You know, there's no rule, there's no law, there's nothing that says it could be $30, or there's nothing that says it could be $1,000. You know, so it's a difficult question to answer, I guess, is where I'm going with that.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that we're probably going to be talking about and what drives the price up is what you call it, perception, you know, whether it perceived value.
And supply and demand.
And, Well, obviously, the more expensive wine is going to cost more to make, but probably that's not really the driving factor in the price.
If that question is for me, that's not necessarily true, because there are some very expensive wines out there that, you know, some people can, you know, buy and have developed, they may have developed a name for their brand and on one particular wine that has gotten high reviews, or you know, they've built up a high demand for that wine, and then they maybe make a second wine that is, let's say it's Cabernet Sauvignon again, and it's a Howell Mountain designation that got all the reviews and all the hoopla, and guy can't, you know, make any more of it and doesn't have any more to sell, so he buys some Cabernet Sauvignon from Napa. And it tends to find a following itself. It may not be quite as expensive, but can be very expensive still and not have all the investment involved as the first one did. So it can be tricky. You know, I think the consumer has to really be aware of what they're looking for.
Okay. Richard, where does the real high-end wine that you broker come from?
Where does it come from in terms of region or from private and people?
Well, that's a good point. But first of all, I don't suppose you can go to the winery and buy this stuff.
No, you can only get it on current release. And if you do, if you're lucky enough to be on the mailing list at release price, you'll get 3 or 6 bottles, perhaps. So we buy and sell in an open market, except ours is a global market.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the things you're going to ask me is, how do we ascertain price? And it's a very good question, because it's perceived price, but there is a market price for all our wines. The most, I'm sure the wine that John knows, the one that gets the very big numbers in California, is a winery called Screaming Eagle.
Mm-hmm.
Screaming Eagle now makes 750 cases, which is 9,000 bottles, which, if you think about it in the context of world demand, is not a lot. Screaming Eagle sells on average there hasn't really been a mediocre vintage, but there have been less stellar vintages, but the minimum you're going to find it for is $1,500 a bottle on the open market.
Whoa.
And if you talk about the 2001 and 2002, they're over $2,000 a bottle, and if you talk about the 1997, it's over $3,000 a bottle. Now, is the wine worth it? Well, let me ask the winemaker, is the wine worth it?
John?
that's always the question of the day. I think personally, you know, my answer is no from tasting wine. If you just line up that wine along with other name brands, you know, from Napa Valley, and even go a step further and do a blind tasting, I think, you know, more often than not, you're going to be disappointed. But then again, you have that, you know, the collector issue where people have, there's a demand for it. And so people are fighting over the few bottles that are there. So my answer would be no, I would never pay that much money for a bottle of wine.
Would you pay $750 for a bottle of Harlan Estate in a good vintage?
No.
I mean,
And the only reason I guess I would is if I had money to spare and a great wine cellar to say that I could resell that wine someday. But for me to consume it and purchase it to consume, I would say no.
When we buy wines from auction or from a private cellar, what's always so fascinating to me is that whatever wine we're buying, if it's a known entity, we obviously don't make the price for the wine that we're buying. What happens is that there is a perceived market level within which we can buy and sell for all of these wines. And it really is. I mean, now, of course, we have the predominance of the auction market, which is the most transparent of all our markets because they're ubiquitous now. They're all over the world. And they set a price for everybody to see. But even before that, all these wines had a price level. And very often the price level, of course, had nothing to do with the release price.
Yeah, they never do, I don't think.
No. And it's a fascinating aspect of the market, of the world I live in, because as I was saying before the program, I'm no longer really a wine merchant. My business has become part of the luxury lifestyle.
Okay.
Entity. Mm-hmm. And that's a true, I don't pretend otherwise, although we sell the finest products, but we're associated with luxury entities.
We're going to have to let you go, John. We're going to be keeping Richard in throughout the whole point. But one quick question, Richard. How do you know if you buy a bottle of wine that's over $1,000? Is there any way that you can tell that it's still good?
We look at the basic preset. What do you look for? Particularly with Bordeaux rather than Burgundy, your most telling feature is where the level of the wine is. We call it the eulage, the distance of the wine
in the cork
from the cork, and the basic criterion is in the neck. If the wine is still in the neck of the bottle, unless it's corked, which you have no way of knowing until you open it, it should be pretty much as described in terms of its tasting notes. Once it gets older and older, we've got another saying, which is there are no great wines, there are only great bottles. Then the storage aspect of it becomes much more relevant, but very difficult.
Yeah.
Very difficult indeed. Burgundies will drive you even crazier because a bottle with a 6-centimeter oolage will taste better than one with a 2-centimeter oolage, and no one can tell you why.
John, we appreciate having you come on real quick. And give us an idea where you're making wine right now.
I'm at Gainey Vineyard right now as director of winemaking here. And, of course, there's always our own little brand my wife and I work together on called Falcone Family. That's a Paso vineyard of my own with a little bit of Chardonnay from Santa Maria.
Okay. Well, I know that you and your wife have worked together for some time, and you're both very, very top-end winemakers, but it makes a great team. And we appreciate that, and thanks for coming on, John.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Okay. You're listening to Cork and Fork Radio. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be right back with Richard Torin, and we're going to find out everything you ever wanted to know about tequila.
Break out the olive oil and balsamic vinegar. We'll be dipping into more adventures next on Cork and Fork SB.
In Santa Barbara since 1949, McConnell's has made super premium ice cream with a guarded secret method of old world technology, using only local fresh cream, eggs, and sugar. There are no artificial ingredients or stabilizers. A container of McConnell's ice cream can weigh almost twice that of its competitors because of the rich, creamy flavor and texture. You will understand the difference with your first taste, and you will know why the Los Angeles Times named it the best of the best. Ask your retailer for McConnell's fine ice cream.
Oriana, Santa Barbara's convenient downtown winery, is known for great wines and fabulous parties. Wine tasting every day starting at 11 and frequent events with entertainment. Check the calendar or create your own special event. The Cellar is a unique event space in the heart of downtown with a fully operating winery. Winemaker Christian Garvin produces on-site your favorite Syrah and Pinot Noir. The award-winning Pinot program and sparkling wines continue to generate rave reviews from the Wine Spectator, the Wall Street Journal, and wine enthusiasts. Bring your friends to the fully stocked wine store, wine tasting room, and winery on the corner of Yananali and Anacapa in the Funk Zone. Sign up for the next semester of Wine University to demystify the wine experience. Class available at Oriana Winery. The knowledgeable, friendly staff will put you at ease and help you explore the world of wine with no pressure. Or, if in the area, just stop in for a glass of wine. O-R-E-A-N-A, OrianaWinery.com.
For over 35 years, Lucas and Llewellyn's estate-grown sustainable vineyards have grown the grapes that produce some of the finest wines in Santa Barbara County. Enjoy the remarkable wines of Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Cabernet, Malbec, and Viognier. The Lucas and Llewellyn Wine Club offers generous discounts to members, as well as fabulous wine country events. Experience the bounty of Santa Barbara County's wine region and become part of the Lucas and Llewellyn family. Visit our beautiful tasting room, located at 1645 Copenhagen Drive in Solvang, California. Visit us on the web at llwine.com.
The Cork and Fork SB Wagon Ride continues now with your host, John Hennigan.
This is John Hennigan with Cork and Fork Radio. We have in studio Richard Torin, who is, very, very interesting person and certainly an eclectic wine dealer, I guess would be one way to put it. There's no question about that. Very select group. And we all have a line with us right now. We have Ruben Salinas, who I had the opportunity to talk to for a little bit yesterday, and found him to be fantastic, very fascinating, and sounds like a young guy, but he seems to know more about tequila than anybody I've ever run across. Now, Ruben, you have an operation in Ojai, correct?
Yes, I do.
And what is that, the restaurant Tequila Bar?
Yeah, it's my family's restaurant and tequila bar. We've been in Ojai for about 20 years now, and we made the move into downtown region about 13 years ago. And then about seven years ago, we started up a tequila bar, and that's where it's just been fun ever since.
Wow. Robert, we've been talking about very fine wines. And up until now, and that's what Richard Torin deals in. But when I mean fine wines, I mean we're talking about, you know, over $1,000 a bottle. And there's been a kind of a revolution or explosion in fine tequila that I've noticed in the last, 10, 15 years?
Yes.
Yeah, it's actually been tequila for the past 10 years has been the most popular spirit on the market. It's really gotten a chance to expand, 10 years ago, there was just a handful of distilleries, and now there's somewhere about 154 distilleries making different types of tequilas that are being brought over to the United States into Japan and Mexico.
Now, when you're talking about the numbers, is that those are all in Mexico or worldwide, or what does that mean?
In Mexico, tequila is very specific, very much like Bordeaux wines or champagne. Tequila can only be made in Mexico, and even more specifically, can only be made in five regions of Mexico. Hmm. If you look at that, I mean, you're looking at obviously the state of Jalisco. It's the number one producing state. They're the ones who, that's where the town of Tequila is from. So that's where most of the tequila is made. There's also Michoacán, Guanajuato, Nayarit, and then on the East Coast side of things, right on the Gulf, there's Tamaulipas.
Okay. Well, wine we know is made from grapes, and tequila we believe is made from the agave plant. How many different varieties of agave are there?
Oh, in Mexico, there's hundreds of types of varieties of agaves. Tequila is very specific. Tequila is very specific to the Blue Weber agave.
Why?
It started off as everyone knows the term mezcal, and mezcal was kind of more during the colonial times when all the Spanish people were bringing in these old distillation methods and on how to make brandy, and they took the natives' agave drink, which they called pulque, and took the mash of that and put it and were able to distill it to create like kind of the first mezcals. And of all the different types of mezcals that were being made, the Blue Weber agave one was kind of became the most popular one. And that was started out in the tequila region of Jalisco. So that's where the term tequila comes from, and that's why it's so specific to that name.
Wow. That's very interesting. And we're talking again about fine wines and fine tequilas. It seems, like I said, 10, 15 years ago, distilled spirits, the very, very most expensive ones would be like some of the brandies or cognacs and maybe scotch. But from what I can tell, when you're looking at the high-end spirit stores, tequila is up there and even surpasses a lot of them.
What's the most expensive tequila on the market?
One of the most expensive ones that's on the market that's available in the United States, I believe, is Glass Azul Añejo. Now, everyone's really familiar with Glass Azul if you've ever been to a tequila bar. It's this beautiful ceramic bottle, and the Reposado sells as much as a really high-end Añejo. Well, their price tag that they're asking for their Añejo, I think it's Añejo, their extra Añejo, is somewhere in the thousands, like $1,200 a bottle, I think. It's really interesting on how there's some tequilas that we can't even get up here that are equally as expensive down there.
But is it...
You know, it really is treated like a scotch or a fine brandy.
But is it... I mean, for the price to get up to this level, is it the reputation? Is it supply and demand? Is it advertising? Is it perception? Why is it $1,200 a bottle? I mean, I can tell you with my Chateau Lafite and Chateau Petrus that these chateaus have been in existence for 200 to 300 years. There's histories, there's vintages, and you know, you can. There's a track record with relatively new products. How do they get to $1,200 a bottle?
When you start to look at it, of all the spirits that are available on the market today, tequila is one of the most expensive ones to actually make.
Why?
It's just that there's so much more that goes into it because there's no additives. It's just the raw plant itself. I mean, traditionally, 100% agave tequila is just the plant itself, and that's where it's getting all of its flavor and all that stuff from. So the distillation method is much more cumbersome, and it takes up much more time and a lot more resources to actually be able to do, from everything from growing the plant. I mean, at minimum, in order for it to be 100% agave, the plant has to be anywhere between 6 to 14 years of age to reach its ripe maturity to be able to be used for that.
And does a plant renew? I'm sorry to interrupt. Ruben, does a plant, once you've cut it down, do you cut the whole plant out, or does it regenerate?
Oh, the entire plant is uprooted. They do keep, you know, they're able to reproduce more and more plants, but they completely uproot the entire plant. And what they do is they'll cut the leaves off and left what's called they call it the piña or the agave core, and it looks like a beautiful pineapple. And then they'll cut that in half and throw that into the clay ovens, and then after that into mashing it up and setting it into the distillation method. So it really is a lot of work to go into it. And, you know, for a while there, Mexico was actually having problems with infected plants and things like that. And a lot of great tequila companies went under.
I was going to ask you, how long does it take to drink? And the answer, of course, is as long as it takes to finish the bottle. But what I really mean is how old can a tequila get?
There's currently a few tequilas out there that are up into the 10-year range. I mean, if you look at it, we've only been aging tequila for about 40 years. There's actually, Herradura was the first company to age their Blanco, their 100% agave tequila, and doing that. So we've only been aging it for about 40 years. The most I've seen from an aged bottle has been about 10 years. And outside of that, I mean, you get close to it anywhere between 6 to 10 years is a really mature, nice extra añejo flavor.
Well, when the fermentation process is it put into barrels?
Yes, tequila can be aged in barrels. In fact, it's preferred if they're used barrels, something that's been used to age something else. So most tequila, they import barrels from either Tennessee or
whiskey barrels.
Or Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Yeah, whiskey barrels. A lot of times, I mean, you can use any type of barrels, but a majority of the time they use bourbon barrels or whiskey barrels or even brandy barrels sometimes.
And the you've got tequila blanco, but where does the color come from in certain tequilas?
With certain tequilas, okay, well, if you're talking about 100% agave tequilas, the coloring is all coming from the oak barrel, and that's also having to do partially with regions, kind of where they have, where the plant was grown. If it's a highland tequila, it tends to be a little bit lighter. There's more minerals in the soil, much more nutrients, so it produces a slightly different color. than a lowland tequila, which ends up picking up a lot more color from like the barrels and just really gets the nice dark oakiness from. If you're talking about something like a Jose Cuervo, like the way you find at a normal supermarket, that's what they call a mixto, and that's actually got caramel coloring into it to get that color.
Richard, I told you this guy knows what he's talking about today.
What he's talking about.
This is fascinating.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Right. Yeah. And where did you, you don't sound like you're old enough to have gained all this knowledge. So you and your family have been doing this for some time.
Yeah, we've been doing this for some time. Shortly after we opened up the restaurant or the tequila bar side of things, you know, my dad really wanted to bring tequilas to a town that really didn't have anything. I mean, the Ojai's got a few bars and the great bars and all that, but no place around here did anything specialty like that. Where really focus in on tequilas. So we started doing that. And my dad, him being from Zacatecas, he does a lot of work with the Mexican consulate. They're based out of Oxnard. And so they'd come up and one day they brought someone who was working in the tequila products and all that. And he knew a lot of these people who were tequila masters and all that stuff. So they came up and they kind of recognized us for what we were doing and all that stuff. So with a little bit of work, we've actually been able to be accredited by the Mexican Academy of Tequilas.
The Mexican Academy of Tequilas. So there is an official organization.
Hmm. Yes. Hmm. I couldn't believe it myself when I first heard it, too, but I was so glad to find out about it.
Good. Well, we're going to have to let you go, but a couple of quick questions. If we come and visit with you, was it Los Caporales?
Yes, Los Caporales. Right, okay. We're right in the heart of downtown, right next to Liberty Park. Tequila bar is separate from the restaurant, but right next door to each other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, come in and we do formal educations and, you know, do tequila tastings. You get on a mailing list, we'll let you know when we do a big tequila tasting. As of right now, I know we have one coming up in November for our restaurant's anniversary. And last year we had 35 tequilas for tasting. So you get to learn a lot
about food.
Food. Oh, I mean, it's all family recipes. Everything that my family has done is very much more Central Mexico, so a little bit much more on the authentic side. Not Tex-Mex by any means. It's not border food. This is traditional Mexican cuisine.
Border food. Yeah, that's good. Now, if we wanted to have the opportunity to try and taste some of that higher end tequila, is it possible to do that in a tasting room?
Yes. Yes, there is. We can accommodate for a lot of different flavors. We can do any type of flights you'd like. Sample a 1 ounce taster of any type of tequila, and we just do a special price on that. So, yeah, we're pretty accommodating, and to have the variety, you know, come in and, you know, time to find something new besides that bottle of Patron and that bottle of Jose Cuervo.
Well, Ruben, I guarantee you that I'd like to come in, and maybe we'll see if we can get up there and learn firsthand about what the difference is between some of the better tequilas.
Yes.
But what I do know that I've had the experience of having some good tequila. When you wake up the next morning, you feel completely different than you would have.
You say the same thing about wine.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Of all the spirits, it's the best one. It's really the best one for you. I mean, the agave plant is low glycemic count, so it makes it really, really easy on your system to digest. Mm-hmm. And as long as it's 100% agave.
And it doesn't have the sugars as much as the distilled spirits. Is that correct?
That's correct. Well, it has its own natural sugars, but it's your body's able to break it down better.
Hmm. Fascinating. We could do a whole hour on this. We just haven't even started to scratch the surface. Ruben, we'll let you go. And you're located in downtown Ojai?
Yes, 307 East Ojai Avenue. We're right next to Libby Park in the Sucker Building right across from the arcade.
Okay. Do you have a website? Or Facebook?
Yes, we have a Facebook page, so you can look us up on Los Caporales Restaurant and Tequila Bar.
Okay.
We also have a website that will be up hopefully in the next couple months. We're in the middle of revamping it, but that will be loscaporalesrestaurant.com.
Okay. All right, we appreciate that very much, Robert, and we're going to stop in and see you. We're going to take a one-minute break right now. You're listening to Cork and Fork Radio, and we're going to be right back, and we're going to be talking to Fred Brander. We've got some interesting things to cover there, so stay tuned.
More tasty morsels on the Cork and Fork SB journey just ahead.